from stpcatalyst.com.
Hello again, I'm Bill DeYoung. This is the Catalyst Sessions. Thanks for tuning into the St. Pete Catalyst Facebook page. I'm happy to say that today my guest is King of the World, Master of the Universe, coolest man in town. His baby left him for a Mexican wrestler. He's Kirk Adams. Hey, man.
How are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you too, man. You're okay. Where's the camera? Where are we looking?
I'm just looking at you.
Okay, well, all right. So you look aloof, you know.
I know. This is looking straight, but I'm looking off to the left. This is the weird thing about cameras.
Okay, well, musicians aren't supposed to understand technology.
I'm really looking at you. I'm looking right at you.
Okay, well, I'm looking right at you too. Here's looking at you, kid. Kirk is a musician, as if you didn't know, folks. He's a singer, songwriter, guitar player, a band leader, an incredible musician who's been around here for 24 years, 23 years now.
I don't talk about time.
A while. How about we do that?
Time is a mystery to me.
Let me start by saying, before we talk about records and music and all kinds of cool stuff, Kirk has 6 records out, by the way, and I suspect there's a 7 in the pipe somewhere. What's your gigging situation like? Have you played at all? Has anything changed?
Yeah, just recently I've started working a little bit at the Hideaway on Friday nights, but I was really taking the quarantine seriously and avoiding any opportunities really to do any working until things started getting normal. I'm not sure they're normal now, but you know, it wears on you after a while and you're just, taking the opportunity to play at the Hideaway. I love working there and I love John and scene there. And it seems pretty safe. So
what you do at the Hideaway, there's a small audience that's spaced and they stream it. What's the deal? I haven't talked to John in a while. I don't know how it's evolved.
Sure. Well, what's happening right now is we're leaving the doors open. So there's seating outside and there's limited seating inside. And he does stream the show as well. But we're playing inside on the stage.
But
all the regular precautions are being observed and masks inside.
Yeah.
All that stuff, you know. It's strange, I will admit, you know, openly, but trying to find a way to navigate through all this madness, you know.
Yeah, no kidding. As a professional musician, this past 6 months, man, how bad did it, you know, clean your clock, as they say? I mean, how bad was it?
Yeah, I cleaned it pretty good. You know, all of us got some money from the government and stuff, which helped a lot. And I managed to get a few songs out, recordings out, that I felt were pretty, you know, professionally done and sound great. And a lot of people paid too much, you know, for the songs, you know, and helped me out quite a lot, which was very kind. And so there was a lot of support from you know, my friends and things like that who come out to see the shows. And other than that, just, you know, hunkering down and trying to, you know, eat a lot of cheese.
Yeah. Yeah, man, I went through so much peanut butter, I can't tell you. But so does this Hideaway thing kind of represent like kind of putting your toe back in the water, or is this as far as you're willing to go for now? You said you've been taking this very seriously, which is brilliant, you know, but some people are going out and playing the clubs again, you know?
Yeah, I'm not in a big hurry to do that. This is really still a little bit of an experiment. This will have been our second one passed. I've got a third one coming up tomorrow and just trying to feel it out and I'm definitely going to, you know, play through September, and I'll be talking to John about October, what we want to do, or if I want to keep going. I don't really know. I mean, there's such a cognitive dissonance between, you know, the animal part of you that wants to go out and live your life and do things, and of course, you know, and survive and make money. And then, of course, the, you know, the sane part that's like, you know, you should just hole up forever. But, you know, I went and got tested for COVID yesterday. I'm trying to get a baseline of where things are at and try to be as careful as I possibly could be. Hope to go like almost once a week. You know, it's free. It's not that big of a hassle in the middle of the day, and just kind of get an idea of where things are at, you know.
You feeling good? I mean,
I feel fine. It's just
being careful, right? Yeah.
Yeah, just a precautionary matter. Once I figured I'm going to go out in the public, really, as ridiculous, I mean, as selfless as it sounds, the most terrifying thing to me is getting somebody else. I mean, I don't want to get sick, that's for sure, but if I do, that's on me, and I'll deal with that. But I would feel terrible, you know, spreading it. I feel really bad. So I'm trying to at least make sure I'm not doing that again.
Yeah. Good on you. Kirk, you're from Fort Lauderdale. Was it Fort Lauderdale proper or just the area around there? Are you from Dania or one of those places?
Well, I was from, I actually grew up in Pompano Beach. I went to school in Deerfield Beach. So we were just north of Fort Lauderdale.
But okay.
You know how it is with big towns. When you're close to a big town, you just say Fort Lauderdale and they know where you're at, you know.
I knew friends of mine lived in Plantation. And they would say, nah, just come down to Lauderdale, you know, turn right or whatever, you'll find it, you know. You told me once that you were a young magician at one time.
But I was fascinated with magician when I was young. I still know, you know, if you know a couple of little card tricks, you can, you know, make that into about, you know, four or five tricks, but it's really one trick, you know.
We talking about like little kid times or you know, were you or was it sort of as you were a teenager, you were still doing prestidigitation?
Very nice. I would say, you know, preteen, really, you know, once I got start getting in my teenage years, I got more into music and, you know, being introduced to, you know, school, I played trumpet in the school and started meeting young, you know, I met a lot more young musicians than I met young magicians. So,
and not to put too fine a point on it, but I don't think magicians get the girls particularly.
I don't think so.
I mean, that would be a real pivot point as far as I can see.
You got to have the really cool facial hair like, you know, those guys in Vegas, I think. They're not getting chicks either. Who are we kidding? They're not getting any chicks either.
Well, you don't think Doug Henning had like groupies? You know, maybe.
I don't know. I think he just loved the world. He was one of those guys. He didn't have sex. Doug Henning? Too pure.
Interesting guy. He was into TM, right? Wasn't Henning the guy who was into
machine,
all that stuff? Yeah. So eventually you say music took you over. I think you had older siblings who had a cool record collection. Is that the story?
Oh, indeed, yeah.
Yeah,
they were actually musicians and performing musicians and stuff. They were really, really, you know, good.
Oh, so it was around the house all the time, sure.
Oh, yeah. Right in the living room, you know, a lot of times rehearsing, and I would fall asleep next to the bass bends and the drums and just have a, you know, good old time. I really enjoyed it. And I had never really wanted to be a musician initially. I think it was because, in retrospect, I think it was because they were so good. There was like an instinct to not compete in any way with something your siblings were so good at. But it just, luckily I was absorbing it all and it came pretty naturally once I started picking up an instrument. So
we're talking British Invasion and maybe like the sort of new wave era, that kind of thing.
Yeah. That's exactly what they were doing. You know, they were kind of doing what I used to call unpopular pop, really, at the time still. You know, they did a little Bebop Deluxe and Steely Dan.
Oh, yeah.
You know, while the club bands were really doing, like, Foreigner and, you know.
And the Doobie Brothers. Yeah.
They kind of were left of center a lot in my first introduction to a lot of the new wave stuff, you know, Talking Heads and things like that. And that's really like where I kind of feel like my genesis as a musician really kind of started with the new wave era, really, the Cars and the Police. And that was the first.
Did you start playing electric or acoustic first?
I started off on bass.
Okay.
Yeah, hence my love of Paul McCartney, or I think part of it, you know.
Yeah.
But I started off on bass, but, you know, always had a piano around the house and guitars. And when it came time to try to showcase my own material, obviously I had to pick up a chordal instrument. So I started playing guitar, more acoustic guitars at the folk houses and singing my songs.
You know. Oh, yeah. I think everybody goes through that. You know, I dropped off the radar early on, but that's what I was doing too. Years ago, we're talking about, you know, didn't have the stamina or the talent like somebody like you. Did you play like in a band with your brothers, sisters? I don't know how that shakes out. Was there a family band at some point?
Not really. I don't think any of us were in the band at the same time, really. But when I was older, I did play like in a band with them, you know, for a period of years. But we didn't. It wasn't like the Jacksons or anything. We were kind of working, really, at the time, you know, just making money and doing gigs and living our lives.
The Addams Family, right?
I know. We were trying to avoid that, but apparently you can't get away from it.
I don't know if you can see me, but I'm snapping my fingers over here.
Yeah, great song.
So let's talk about influences, though. You mentioned McCartney, and the Beatles runs in all of our veins in one way or another. Yeah. So what are the sort of things that really you know, molded you musically?
Well, I think the things that first really started making sense to me was Elvis Costello and Squeeze. Mm. You know, when I first started hearing that stuff, it was sort of a familiar, it's like, yeah, I get this. And I almost was like the neo fight little songs that I was writing kind of resembled that already, you know, and it was sort of like finding somebody who's like, oh, that's how you do it. You know, that's right. What I'm trying to accomplish, you know, in many ways.
So and that's still, kind of, I mean, Costello is drawn from, you know, pop and British Invasion, but also from R&B. But he also had that lit. I was talking with Ed Waltell about this just a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. There's a slightly literary bent. The lyrics were really good. It wasn't
definitely, yeah.
I love, she loves Bebopaloo. You know, it wasn't that stuff. Right. So that reached out and got you, in other words.
Yeah, I think like one of the albums that I dug out of the record collection was Trust. I think it was a really big one for me when I first heard Trust. And I think the whole atmosphere of like, there seemed to be like an underlying theme to all the songs to me when I heard it, you know, with Clubland, you kind of got the idea of a nightclub scenes and all these little plays playing out. I don't know if he intended it or not, but, and it, to me, it really just spoke to me as like a whole, almost if it had been cooler, it would have been a whole culture of its own sort of a thing. There was a vibe to it that I just really adored, and the acoustic pianos and the, and yet it was an ensemble band. It was just a 4-piece band, you know, it was just a really great piece of work. I think that's a great record, really. One of
that
my
was the, to me, that's the pinnacle of the early attractions was Trust. I love Imperial Bedroom too, but for different reasons. Lover's Walk and You'll Never Be a Man. I mean, yeah. Yeah. I had just started college up in Gainesville. I think that was the first album I bought when I moved to Gainesville. And so, you know, I don't know how it is with you, but when I hear those songs, I'm there. I'm driving up and down 13th Street in Gainesville on the way to school.
Well, absolutely. It's a real evocative record for me too, you know, because of just how much it impacted me, you know?
Yeah. So it's interesting that you said that the songs that you were writing, the neo songs is what you said, kind of were in line with that sort of thing. Now, Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook are sort of, I wouldn't say they're literary, but they're very literate.
Yeah.
You know, they were smart songs and snarky in great ways. I mean, is that what you, is that lyrically the, you know, what you were doing as well?
Well, let's go back to the concept of neo songs. I was never a really particularly good lyricist starting out, I don't think. I could usually find maybe like a turn of a phrase for a hook, but then the rest of it would sort of fill in the blanks in a lot of ways. But I think a lot of it were attempts at cleverness, because you're young, you want to be clever, and you want, that's when you're not a big jock or something, you rely on your intellect and your wits, you know. So you, I would try to write things that were, that seemed clever to me. But that all, you know, my lyric writing, you know, got better as I got older, thank God. But a lot of it was in the melodies and the structure of the songs.
Oh yeah.
And there's always a zeitgeist to a certain kind of melody. There is today with songs. I hear a certain melody, a little inflection with music these days that's all the same in a nice way. But I mean, like, it's just the times, you know. And I think there was a certain tweak to the melodies, a certain way that a melody pushed against a chord that was sort of similar. And so when I found out, you know, Paul McCartney and Elvis Costello were doing songs, I was like, well, this is going to crush me, you know.
They're great. You've heard the bonus stuff, all the other stuff that came out after Flowers in the Dirt a few years ago with the two of them.
Yeah, I tried to pay attention to that, yeah.
Demos and everything. Some of that stuff is so good. And okay. I think that some of the songs they never released were better than the ones on the records. You know,
yeah.
McCartney used to do that all the time. He used to put really great songs on the B sides.
Yeah, no doubt.
And you'd kind of go, "Oh, the A side's kind of smelly or whatever," you know, because you know, hey, let's talk about McCartney. Let's take a few minutes here, you and me, because we're both geeks of a feather. And since it's my show, I can do this. So what the hell? Give me a list of. Let's start. Let's do them one at a time. Your five favorite Paul McCartney songs. Take one and tell me what it, let's run down the list, then I'll tell you one of mine.
Well, I'm going to go with it's kind of personal faves, so they're going to be a little less probably familiar to a lot of people.
Yeah.
But as opposed to like, I mean, I've got a list of like songs that everybody would know that are my top five.
Oh, that's no fun. Let's hear your personal faves.
So I love Single Pigeon off of Red Road Speedway.
Single Pigeon yeah. would be on my second five.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic song. That's a simple little melody. Just a beautiful, beautiful little melody, just him on the piano. Tell me why that works for you.
Well, I mean, I think that it has a lot of imagery to it. I think it sets a beautiful scene, you know, with him sitting on a park bench in Regent's Park and, the pigeon and just the atmosphere is fantastic. And one of the great things about when Paul hits is when he has both that atmosphere and the lyrics and melody that match. And when it all comes together, it's just absolute magic. And there's a subtle, I think it's just like a horn band arrangement in there too, like a small quartet of horns.
French horn or something, yeah.
Yeah, something.
Yeah.
Little, thing. And once again, it's got that very distinctive McCartney style of where he's playing the melody that he's singing like he does on Martha, My Dear, or a lot of things. It's just a certain style of his that's just so perfect. And I just think that really encapsulates it. Where it falls on the album, everything about it, I think it's just great,
For mine, for my first one, I'm going to go with the same album and say Get on the Right Thing.
I was just talking about that song last night, too.
What a great song. And I think that was started for Ram and held up, right? And then ended up on Red Road Speedway. But there's such a great energy to it. And as usual with so many of his great pop songs, the lyrics don't make any sense at all.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. It's just a great energy and a great vibe. And
when he hits it, it's like, it doesn't matter that it doesn't make any sense. I mean, I think we probably talked about, and I'm sure a song will end up on there, but like Ram is like one of my favorite albums of all time.
Me too.
It's pretty hard to find anything that means much of anything on that record anyway, but it really doesn't matter. That album sounds so great. And the songs are just so perfectly executed and produced and performed that it's one of the great records.
Dear Boy. How could anybody come up with that? The harmonies are great.
Unbelievable.
That Ram came out right at the same time as the first Emmett Rhodes album in 71. Ah. And I remember listening to the two of them back to back constantly. Mm-hmm. And obviously McCartney was McCartney, but I loved Emmett Rhodes' songcraft too. Give me another one from your list. What do you got?
My phone is being a pain. Okay. I really like Mrs. Vanderbilt off of the Band on the Run album.
Okay.
Just
tell
a pumping bass line. Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a pumping bass line. And once again, it's got that strange, ambiguous lyrics but in a way that they sort of like, he's saying something, I think he's getting it, sort of a poverty gap sort of circumstance, and with Mrs. Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
And sort of like, I guess, if you want to make something out of it, sort of an anti-capitalist, sort of a statement, but really when it gets down to it, it's just that the hook of it and the bass line is just fantastic. It's so loud in the mix, and it shouldn't be anywhere else, but it's way up in the mix like that. So good.
Let me talk to you about Girls' School from 79.
Oh, yeah.
From 79. The B-side.
That's a B-side, isn't it?
B-side of Mull of Kintyre, mm-hmm. or the A-side, depending on what side of the Atlantic you happen to be on, I guess. Girls' School is a rocker, and like Junior's Farm, it is an unapologetic screaming rocker and with a little bit of poppy tints to a little too much Linda in there for me, but it's just a cool pile driving song. And hardly anybody knows this song. Even the album it was paired with later, London Town, is out of print at the moment, So nobody's out there going, wow, Girls' School, great tune. I don't think he's ever played it live, but I love that. I love when he does that kind of song. Your turn.
How many times did he play Beware My Love,
I'm not crazy about the song itself, but I love the way he sings it on the record.
Yeah, absolutely. But I would love to have heard Girls' School live. I think it's probably too late now.
Yeah, I guess. I don't think he can hit the notes anymore.
Here's another weird one. I think it's weird anyway, but it's always stuck with me. It's been one of my favorite little poppy numbers of his that I think is pretty unknown, is She's My Baby. From I think it's Speed of Sound.
It's on Speed of Sound, yeah.
Great song. Just a pop, just a perfect piece of pop perfection, You remember it much? She's my baby. She comes out at night.
Yeah.
And it's got like the Fender Rhodes where he's got the it's like a stereo, it's like set to stereo, so the Rhodes is kind of doing this through the whole thing. But once again, it's a pretty simple little, it's a band playing,
Yeah.
And just a great set of chords, a great cheerful sort of vibe, which is like gravy. I keep lapping it up.
I know. And that's the kind of song that I'll end up singing while I'm washing the dishes, when I'm my wife is out of earshot and I can sing something as dumb as that. But yeah, it's that's part of his genius. Is that it doesn't have to make any sense. It's just it's an earworm, and the record is so brilliantly made. From the same album, my next one is San Ferian.
Oh geez, what a great song that is.
And San Ferian means something. It's a reference to World War I, I think. I looked it up once. It's an old British reference, and I'm here to tell you I don't remember what. But we should be having this conversation over a couple of beers somewhere in a bar. But I love that song, and it's just a nice little, very subdued little melody. It's a lot like Single Pigeon. It just kind of goes along. And
that's a beautiful song. That's got a lot of good songs on that album that I think people miss, too. There's a lot of good stuff on it. Does that have Cafe on the Left Bank on there?
No, that's London Town. That's on London Town. Good tune. Well, you got it. Your turn. What do you got?
That would be nice if that was a nice segue to my next choice, but it wasn't, even though I do love that song. I love Love and Song off of, I think that's Venus and Mars.
Venus and Mars. Yeah, Love and Song is great. That's an aching melody.
Once again, it's just the atmosphere of it is so perfect. And I don't even think it's a really good recording when you listen back to it too much. It's a little murky. It comes in a little quiet compared to the other songs and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, just the actual atmosphere of the song is unbelievable. Once again, precisely what he's talking about, I think it would be hard to put your finger on, you know, happiness in the homeland. I don't know exactly what he's thinking about there. But
more great but lyrics. Yeah, right.
Freaking horns at the end there. Ba, 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 ba. It's just like
I forgot that was on this. You know, I would have said Call Me Back Again too from that album. The horns are killer on that.
And a great vocal once again.
Yeah, screaming. Yeah. Hey, I got one for you. How about Bridge on the River Suite? Do you know that one?
Bridge on the River Suite. It's instrumental, isn't it?
Yeah. It was the B-side of Walking in the Park with Eloise that they cut in Nashville as the Country Hams. Huh. But actually, there's an early mix of it. It was cut during Red Rose Speedway. And there's an early mix on it. It's an instrumental, folks, if you don't know this one. The early mix you get on a bootleg somewhere. Doesn't have the horns, and instead there's an acoustic guitar playing all the horn riffs. Da 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 da. It's so cool, very moody and evocative. It's a 3-minute instrumental that will kill you. The guy is unbelievably talented.
I have to double check on that one because I haven't.
I'll send you the MP3. I got it around somewhere. It's your turn. We only have one left, I think.
Well, I think that you'll like this one. There's a bit of a caveat, but not much of one. I love Heaven on a Sunday from, I think that's Flaming Pie.
Flaming Pie. Yeah.
That's just a beautiful melody. It's such a great, once again, he sets a great atmosphere and you kind of can feel it. The only thing that is difficult about that song to me, and I still stand by it as a choice, but I don't love the extended kind of guitar solo stuff in the middle with his. I'm not crazy about it, but it doesn't really deter me. But I did one time do a little digital edit where I just took that out for my own. And it's like, just with that out of there, it's really like
the beauty of audio editing software.
Yeah, exactly. All you hear is,
I think that's one that George Martin said was like one that he really liked.
It's really nice.
He commented on it. You know, I mean, he was peripherally involved with that album, but I think he said, this is a beautiful melody. Some days on that album, I love Little Willow. I love all the acoustic stuff on that record. My last choice is from I guess it was cut in 79. It's called Secret Friend.
It's
10 minutes of electronic exotica that it basically sounds like Carmen Miranda on acid. And it's all just him messing around with the synthesizer and overdubbing his voice a million times. It goes on for 10 minutes. It's hypnotic. It's sort of McCartney's version of I Feel Love by Giorgio Moroder and Donna Summer. It just goes on and on, but it's cool and tropical and really, really weird. And I absolutely love it.
It is really weird. And I love a lot of the songs on that record too. I think it's a little bit maligned. There's some really, really especially terrible songs on that record too. I think there's a lot more gold in there than people give it credit for. I've seen people, talk about, they're like, well, Coming Up is good and maybe Waterfalls or something, and that's about it. And I'm like, no, there's a lot of good stuff on that record.
I love the stuff he left off that came out in the bonus disc.
Check My Machine. I don't mind listening to.
Check My Machine. Oh, what's the, All You Horse Riders. Why are you doing that funny voice? That's the thing about McCartney. Anything that would come into his head, he'd just go in and record it, and it's not all brilliant. Like you said.
Yeah.
So, Ram, is your Ram is your favorite album, though, right?
Well, it's it kind of has to be, also because of the personal, you know, when I heard it and stuff. But I do think it's a great record. Anyway, look at it.
Yeah. I think it's his most consistent record. I mean, it's you're right. It's hard to be objective about something like that.
Yeah.
You know, it meant a lot to me, too, when I was very young. But I think, I'm not a huge fan of Band on the Run. Right. I think there's a couple of great songs in there, but I just heard it so much. It's like, you know, it's like when you listen to the Beatles channel on Sirius XM and they play Come Together and Let It Be and Don't Let Me Down. And I want to scream. They play the same song. I can't really hear Band on the Run anymore.
Yeah. I feel their pain.
Oh, it's cool. Yeah. I got to go check out Mrs. Vanderbilt again. I hadn't thought about that song in a long time.
Down in the jungle, living in a tent.
You don't pay money. You don't pay rent. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it probably had a lot to do with where they recorded that, too, where they recorded it.
Lagos.
Yeah, right, exactly, yeah.
Your most recent album, I'm going to do a segue here. Your most recent album is called Night Owls, Boogaloo, and Bottle Club.
Yes.
Right? This is from 2018. This is the one with Mexican wrestler on it and my all-time favorite, Alien Implant.
Oh, yeah.
What you got something in the pipeline now? What's going on there?
Yeah, I do. Well, before before all this happened, I was working on a couple projects, and one of them was I was working hard to take specific songs and have people produce them that I respected, like actually, you know, spend the time to produce and do, instead of it just being a one-man effort, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like in most of it. And so I have been doing like kind of a series of singles still, but they may all end up on the same record. And then I'm working on a separate record right now that is much like Boogaloo and Bottle Club, that is sort of a band that I've been playing with at the Hideaway and the song that came to life at the Hideaway, you know. So those are the two things I'm working on right now.
These singles, I mean, have you been sort of letting them slip out digitally and like over this time? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, yeah. The first that I did, Here and Now, I got a really good friend of mine from Austin to produce and do a lot of, she plays bass on it and does a lot of the background keyboards. So just basically arranged and edited the song and you know, together, but you know, it was her production. And I think it came out really good. I got a fantastic artist from New York to do some artwork for it, Kristen Aldi. And so I was trying to like do that sort of a thing. But then of course, once the pandemic hit, you know, my liquid cash flow, you know, rapidly disappeared.
And so you gotta start like worrying about groceries and stuff like that, right?
Well, absolutely, yeah. And really, I mean, I think for me and like a lot of other people, just maintaining your disposition and not being, I mean, I got pretty depressed when it hit because I sort of structured my life and my gigs to be really good for me. Like I was working with a great group of people and all the gigs that I have are gigs that I enjoy and playing music that I like to do and a lot of original gigs with the Hideaway and stuff. And so when that hit, it did sort of throw me for a loop as far as like, what's my life going to be like now? What's, you know, how important is this, you know? And can I get my head into the music, or is it, you know, where it's just kind of cognitive dissonance is the best way I can put it. I just got very
freaked out. I mean, you remember when I first asked you to do this show, you were like, I don't think I'm ready. Or like, not now. It was quite a while ago.
Yeah. Well, I feel depressing. I feel like I'm depressing the conversation now by even talking about that. So you can imagine what it would be like, you know, 4 months ago, it would have been like, you know.
It's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And
thank you.
Thanks for geeking out with me, man. That was fun. I hope we get to do more of that stuff. Well, folks, we'll do the rest of it somewhere that's not in a public forum, though, so you don't have to listen to it. But go check out those tunes. When you said Single Pigeon, man, I almost fell on the floor. That was because that was on my short list right up until the end. Because I love that. I love those little, is it Oasis? The little Oasis in the middle of his records where you go, I didn't see that. I love Ram On. It's like a minute and a half long.
Absolutely. You know,
just comes out of nowhere and blows your mind.
I would contend that he's a much more experimental artist than people give him credit for either. Everybody talks about him as a pop artist, but really, I mean, even from the beginning, from his first record, was basically the first do-it-yourself, you know, album, you know, and he was already experimenting on that with some crazy stuff, and not all of it's once again fantastic. But
Green Aquari, thank you.
Exactly what I'm thinking. But he was expanding his thought to, but like you said, those little segues like glasses, and he's just doing, you know, like he was always experimenting, I think, more so than really people try to give Lennon the credit for being more experimental. But I think Paul was always up to something, and he still kind of is.
Hey, man, when Lennon experimented, we got some time in New York City. I mean, say no more. You know, I'm hoping to start working soon on a book. I'm going to write a book about the relationship between Lennon and McCartney right when they broke up and why they both brought their wives in as their partners. They're not musical. There's some psychological thing going on there.
Yeah. And,
one of these days. Kirk, we're out of time. Good talking to you. Give my best to Gail, and we will see you out on the road again soon, I hope.
Well, sir, appreciate it.
Brother, take care of yourself.
Have a nice day.
Bye.
From stpetecatalyst.com.